I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Two Kansas communities have dealt with swatting recently when police are fooled into sending out a SWAT team to a residence. In January, Overland Park Police sent units but conducted no raid after a hoax call. Last year, Wichita Police killed a man in a swatting incident. Today, we demystify the trend and find out how Kansas lawmakers are responding. Then, from the Women's March to Never Again, young women are leading activism these days, but their continued engagement isn't guaranteed. We'll learn about the obstacles standing between young women and activism and get advice for overcoming them. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas lawmakers these days are looking at new legislation aimed at cracking down on swatting. That's this new age hoax that involves officers being dispatched to non-existent emergencies. It's an insidious crime, and it's already resulted in a fatal shooting in Wichita, the first such fatal swatting shooting in the country. It happened late last year after a Wichita police officer shot and killed an innocent man when responding to a fake emergency call. But what should an anti-swatting bill look like? What are the potential pitfalls? We're about to find out. With us, Kansas State Representative Patty Markley is an Overland Park Republican. She's co-sponsoring legislation to crack down on swatting. And Representative, so nice to have you here. Thanks for taking the time.
Absolutely, Steve. Thanks for having me.
John Lacey is also here in the studio with me. He's the public information officer for the Overland Park Police Department, which in January experienced its own swatting case. John, good morning to you.
Good morning also. Thanks for having me.
And on the phone with us, Mark Fletcher is a chief architect for Worldwide Public Safety for Avaya, and he's an emergency numbers professional, phone number professional. Mark, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate you having me here today.
You know, John Lacey, start things off for us here. The term swatting is new to a lot of people. Do I assume correctly that swatting is a reference to police SWAT teams?
Correct. A lot of times we're getting these calls, and other agencies are getting these calls, and they're fake calls, and they want us to respond. And as you can see, the situation in Wichita didn't end well. In Overland Park, you know, when we responded, you know, we took our time, things of that sort. And I can't comment on the Wichita situation. I can only comment on Overland Park.
Sure. What happened to your department in January? You know, it would easily fall into the darn frightening category. What happened?
Well, on January the 15th, around 8:30 a.m. in the morning, we received a call from a guy who advised that he had shot his wife and that she was still breathing. With that being said, officers are quick to get to the scene. At that time, he also advised that he also had a high-power weapon. Mm. We don't know what he had, if it was a rifle or a gun, things of that sort. So we set up a perimeter, and we were able to approach the door. At that time, we saw the blinds move, and we retreated. We then contacted our SWAT team, and they responded. But they did not respond to the house, but they were setting up at a nearby school.
Okay. This was a really tense situation then.
Very tense. And, you know, calls like this, we take them very, very serious.
You have to, right?
Correct. You do. And, you know, we didn't find it funny. It took a lot of our time. It took a lot of our resources. You know, we didn't think it was funny at all.
At what point did you figure out this wasn't what you thought it might be based on the phone call your department had received?
You know, I have to commend our dispatch. They were able to follow up, cross-reference the number with the address, and they were able to call the family. And they were able to talk with a young man who advised, you know, Dad is here, Mom's not here, and I'm here with my older brother, and there's no incident here at the house. They came out, and they were very cooperative with us. Mom later showed up to the scene, and we figured out that, hey, look, we were swatted at that point.
So you knew, you had indications right from the onset then that maybe something wasn't quite right here?
Yeah, we've never responded to that residence before. And like I said, you know, we cross-referenced that number. We were able to talk to the child, and he was very articulate and told us, hey, look, there's no incident here. And that's when we had him put his father on the phone, and they came out, and that's when we started a dialogue, and we figured out that we've been it was a hoax, or we were swatted.
Do we know what the impetus for this particular swatting incident was, John?
Not at this time. It's still under investigation. I did have a chance to talk with a detective, and it's still under investigation at this time. So we're making some leads.
So you don't really know for sure then?
No.
You know, Mark Fletcher, you've written on just this issue, how to tell if a call is genuine or not. A big part of the problem is that these calls don't come in directly to the 911 center. Why not?
Well, I think really when someone's looking to SWAT, they're looking to be an imposter, right? So I think people are afraid of calling the 911 network or attempting to SWAT the 911 network. And there's a lot of tools available that easily allow them to mask their caller ID on a regular landline. And they take advantage of that. And a lot of SWATting is actually social engineering. So they'll create this dramatic incident. And in the case of Wichita, it came into, I think, a police substation and was ultimately transferred into 911. So again, they're creating this false scenario that looks real. And by doing that, it just adds to the realism.
Hey, and Mark, just to add to what you're saying, there's this process called spoofing phone calls, which was new to me. What is that? Explain that to our listeners.
So spoofing is, you know, when you make a phone call, the phone company attaches your caller ID and that's delivered to the person that you're calling. Spoofing your caller ID actually has some legitimate uses, Steve. I could be a doctor and I'm calling a patient. I don't want them to have my cell phone number. So I'm going to use a service that masks my caller ID to make it look like I'm calling from the office. A police detective might use the same thing when they're calling someone so they don't have special internal numbers. It's actually got a lot of good uses, but it can be misused for illicit purposes like swatting.
Man, okay. And John, just to make matters worse, at the Overland Park Police Department, you had a second swatting call around the same time as the first one. Do I have that right?
No, I don't. No.
Not sure?
No, it wasn't our agency. Not our agency.
Not your agency.
Correct.
Okay. But this situation could have gone south in a real hurry if certain things hadn't happened here, it sounds like.
Yes, sir, definitely.
Yeah, okay. Representative Markley, I gather this incident is what got you engaged in backing a bill in the legislature that deals with swatting. What do you want to do here?
Right, Steve. Well, the incident that happened in Overland Park was in my district. And I had discussions with Representative John Whitmer and Representative John Carmichael, who are both representatives from Wichita who had started down the path for this legislation.
Where the fatality had occurred.
Late last year. And the bill that we have introduced is House Bill 2581. And that does a few things. It changes the term of what's on the terminology of what's on the books now from giving a false alarm to making an unlawful request for emergency services. So it just kind of cleans that up. And current law, really the only consequences are a misdemeanor or a very low-level felony for making that claim. And what we have done, we've added some felony-level consequences for that. So there's a level 6 felony for if bodily harm results from this. It can go up to a level 4 felony if grave bodily harm, and all the way up to a level 1 felony if death is involved as a result of these calls.
It's your belief, no question, the time has come to elevate the potential punishment here.
Absolutely. It's not just a prank call. I mean, if that call, similar to, say, you start a fire and it's arson, if somebody dies or is hurt as a result of that, what you've done, the consequences should be in line with that. So absolutely.
Officer John Lacey, again, with the Overland Park Police Department. Is this your department in favor of what the representative wants to do here?
We are 100% behind it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you have to understand, like I said, it took a lot of time and resources. You know, you're looking at about close to $2,500 because a lot of those guys were coming out on overtime.
I'm wondering, Mark Fletcher, as you look across the world, are we seeing a rise in the number of bills in response to swatting incidents across the country and maybe even across the world?
Well, I think it's fair to say that across the country, swatting is relatively easy to do. And you've got incidents that you know, that are happening, and it's important that they're getting in the news. And most importantly, it's important that they're finding out that they're capturing these people. So in the case of Wichita, they were able to identify that person fairly quickly. The technology is there, but it is happening more and more. It does happen globally, although it's not as prevalent as in the U.S. So I deal a lot in Europe with the European Emergency Number Association. And while this is a concern, and they do educate their call takers, really don't see the problem happening.
Hmm. Representative Markley, what's the difference between the law you're proposing and the longstanding crime of simply filing a false police report?
Well, now we just have teeth, and what we're doing has graver consequences than what's currently on the books now. So like I said, currently it's just a misdemeanor or a very low-level felony if you were to do this. So now the consequences are in line with what may actually happen, and like we saw in Wichita.
Just guessing here that there'll be fairly broad support for the kind of legislation you're proposing here?
This bill passed the House last week unanimously. We had one amendment that was to name the bill the Andrew T. Finch Act, named after the gentleman who was
young
killed
man
in
who was killed in
was
Wichita.
Killed in Wichita. We just finished what's called turnaround, which means now all the bills that were introduced in the Kansas House now go to the Senate, and likewise Senate bills go to the House for consideration. So this bill has now been referred to the Senate Judiciary Committee. They will take it up. Hopefully it will get to the full Senate. And if they, depending on what type, if they make any changes to it, if it has to go to conference committee, but hopefully this bill can make it to the governor's desk for signature and become law.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about this new crime of swatting, this notion of filing false police reports, making false phone calls as a hoax to get police to respond to a fake emergency here. If you have questions about how the state of Kansas is responding, maybe or even what's happening in Missouri, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. John, you know, time is often the essence in these emergency calls. How can 911 dispatchers quickly verify that these calls are legitimate or illegitimate without sacrificing an efficient response from the police?
You know, anytime we receive a 911 call and someone says I hurt someone, or we're going to respond. And, you know, in this situation, we thought that there was a situation where someone actually shot their wife. And that's why we responded. And that's why we had all the resources out there.
Mm-hmm. You know, Mark Fletcher, again, with Avaya, since these calls are answered by someone other than a 911 dispatcher, what are a few of the giveaways that anyone might pick up on when a fake call comes in?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And really, it's identifying and training for someone who's lying. So there'll be pauses or delays. Or if you look at the Wichita, I think the Wichita case, if you look at the transcript of the phone conversation, you can go through there and you can pick out so many different things that are clear indicators that something probably wasn't right. I mean, things that stood out to me, he mentioned the address probably three or four times, even including the zip code on one of those, making sure that the dispatcher knew exactly the address that he needed to go to. Whenever he was queried on a specific item that could easily be fact checked, there was a delay or a change in the conversation. If you talk to someone who's trained in determining if someone's lying, these are all key traits. Delays in the answer, ums and ahs. You know, what's your name? My name is Steve. Okay. My name is Steve.
Right.
You know,
right.
These are common things.
You know, we haven't really discussed this idea, Mark, of why people are placing these swatting calls. I mean, I guess hoaxes are hoaxes, and they've been going on for as long as human beings have been walking the planet. But what's the intent here? Any feel for that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it started with the gaming industry. People were playing online games, and as in the case with Wichita, somebody lost and they were a little mad, and they went out to try to find somebody to swat the other people. And, you know, here was a guy in California who was known for doing this and was contracted almost to do this.
Do we know how big of an issue this is across the globe, Mark?
Well, again, I don't see a lot of cases outside of the U.S. This is, I mean, it does happen, but not at the rates that it happens in the U.S.
But even in this country, are the numbers going up?
I think they are.
Yeah.
It's difficult to tell because you have to look at the reporting facts. They're certainly in the news more, right? But I would say that more people are becoming familiar. More people are understanding how to do it. And it's not that hard.
Representative Markley, when swatting occurs across state lines, which jurisdiction takes the lead in the legal proceedings? And can you tell us whether a swatter might be subject to multiple state laws?
Actually, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
But, I do know that the incident in Overland Park, it was pinged to a cell tower in Seattle. So, I mean,
really?
it is challenging. Yeah.
Yeah. It happened that quickly. Okay. Let's go to some phone calls here as we talk about swatting and how the state of Kansas is responding to that fatal incident late last year in Wichita. Let's go to Phil from Overland Park. Phil, good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question. If you could see if there's a way to register all of the phone numbers that originate out of your house with a database so that if there is a call that they actually know it's from someone living in that house.
Mark, is that a possibility? Is that a practical solution here?
Well, you know, there is already a database with landline phones and addresses that the phone company keeps. When it comes from a cellular phone, that becomes a little more different. But that brings up an interesting point. There is technology available, and there are companies that offer services that will take the caller ID that you've received, and they will immediately query the telephone network to see if that device is in fact making a phone call. So it might not be 100% correct that it is that call, but if I see you're calling me, Steve, and then I see your phone is not making a phone call, that's an indicator something's wrong.
So technology, then, you're suggesting might be catching up, Mark, with what is going on with this swatting across the country.
Oh, absolutely. We've had conversations with several companies that are using the forensics available in the telephone network to establish if a connection is being made between here and here. And it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like the old movies where they would trace the call, but it's an instantaneous trace,
right,
on the call.
I'm wondering, Mark, if you think state governments, not only in Kansas and Missouri, but across the country, are responding quickly enough based on what happened in Wichita late last year.
Well, I think governments are responding. Until there's a federal law in place, I think it's safe to say that any response is not wide enough or fast enough.
Are federal lawmakers in Washington working on this?
It's being discussed. There have been several notices of inquiry put out by the FCC. There's a group called CISRIC that works on issues similar to this. So it's being discussed, but, you know, things at the federal level tend to move slower than the state level. And what you're probably going to see, my opinion, is you're going to see states be proactive and say, I'm not going to wait for a federal law. I'm going to implement my own law. Now, that's good and it's bad. It's good if everybody has a model to implement after. It's bad if everybody does their own thing and I have to make 50, you know, changes to get everybody on the same page.
Representative Markley, do you worry about what Mark just said there?
Perhaps, but I think that as a Kansas state legislator, and if the event happens in Kansas and I can take action this session to put something on the books that can hopefully help this, then I'm going to do that. I'm not going to wait for the federal government to do it.
Yeah. You know, John Lacey, again, the PIO with the Overland Park Police Department, does your department worry that this situation could get out of hand pretty quickly?
You know, it could happen again. We know that. Every agency in Kansas and Missouri, we know that it could happen to any agency. So we're going to take each situation, you know, for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to look at the where the call's coming from. We're going to ask questions, and then we're going to proceed that way.
Okay. We'll leave our conversation there on the dangers of swatting. I want to thank Representative Patty Markley, an Overland Park Republican, for coming in today. John Lacey with the Overland Park Police Department, and Mark Fletcher, who's an emergency number professional with Avaya. And thank you all for good conversation. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how young women can become more active in our politics. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, the ethics professors unpacked questions about deportation policy, privacy in the Eric Greitens indictment, and how high schools should recognize students lost to suicide. You can find that conversation and others at kcur.org/up-to-date. On Monday's show, we talked to one psychologist about mommy burnout. She'll explain the unique pressures facing today's mothers and how moms can overcome the pressure to seem perfect. That's Monday on Up to Date. So maybe you still have an election 2016 hangover and you're wondering how to get back in the game and stay engaged long term this time. Maybe you're a young adult or the parent of one watching national movements now being led by high school and college students, and you're inspired and wondering how a young person could jump into the fray for the first time. Emma Gray, the executive women's editor at HuffPost, has compiled a new book that strings together some ways to get involved, stay involved, and a whole lot more. That book, A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance, a feminist handbook on fighting for good. Emma Gray joins us now from NPR in New York. And Emma, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
You know, you say in your introduction here that you'd often thought of writing a book, but about a host of other things. What finally made this one come together?
Well, I'm a journalist. I cover the intersection of gender and politics. And so I covered the 2016 presidential election. And I found myself on election night at the Javits Center, where the Clinton campaign was. And my team thought we would be writing a story about our nation electing its first woman president. And instead, obviously, we ended up writing a very different story. And I spent hours on the street interviewing a lot of very grief-stricken Clinton supporters who were full of anger and fear. And then a few months later, I covered the Women's March in D.C., and I got to see firsthand what it looks like when that fear and grief and anger is channeled into civic action. And that just was incredibly moving, and it made me want to explore this burgeoning resistance a little bit more and speak to the women who were leading it.
To what extent is that resistance, the resolve of that resistance, hanging tough, you know, a year and some months into the Trump administration?
I wasn't sure if the energy would keep up. You know, when I Right. went out to cover the second round of women's marches, I wondered, will we see much smaller crowds? Will people be exhausted? And instead, I was in New York this year, and the crowds were massive. People were so energized. I interviewed at least a handful of people who hadn't marched the first time and were out there this year because of, you know, the Me Too movement, Time's Up, the Larry Nassar case. I think there are a lot of things we're seeing that is kind of re-energizing this movement, and that energy is being channeled in different directions on different issues.
So what's the first step for a young person wanting to get involved here then, Emma? I mean, you write about going to an LGBTQ rights march when you were a kid, but, you know, for some kids, they're not being raised in a politically active environment. So what does this girl do on day one there?
It can be incredibly overwhelming,
yes.
And I acknowledge that. And I think the most important thing to do is start small. Pick one thing that you feel passionately about, something that you think you can have the energy to, you know, run the marathon, not the sprint on. And then simply look at an organization that is working on that issue already, or an individual, and either send that person an email or go on that organization's website and ask them, I have X amount of time, I have X amount of money, what can I do to help you? What can I do to help the work that is already being done? The beauty here is that on pretty much every issue, you don't have to create something new. You just have to show up for the work other people are already doing.
And young women, young people in general are intimidated oftentimes to engage because why? It's complicated. They don't really fully understand the issue. They don't think they're smart enough. What goes into that calculus?
Young women in particular are a group that is taught to make themselves small, whose voices and opinions are so often dismissed. And yet, there is a long and beautiful history in this nation of young people of all genders being the driving force behind social movements. And so I wanted to be really clear that, you know, what we're seeing in Parkland right now is building off of the work that young people in communities of color have been doing around gun control for decades. We saw young people leading, you know, the women's liberation movement, Gloria Steinem as a young woman, like Diane Nash taking charge in the civil rights movement. So while young people are often dismissed and can feel belittled or overwhelmed, at the same time, they are building off of such a beautiful tradition of being the energizers of change.
One thing I've noticed as someone who's written about politics for many years for the newspaper here is this idea that, you know, these causes oftentimes require a long game. It's not going to happen in a week or 3 days. You're looking at months and maybe even years of effort, and that can be a little daunting sometimes.
Absolutely. And that's why it's so important to take those small steps. You don't have to change the world overnight. Just show up and chip away at what you can. Maybe that's, you know, lobbying your school board to expand their education on consent in the sex ed curriculum. Maybe that's finding a city council candidate that you really support and going out and canvassing for them a couple of times. We don't need to always create a new movement and change things, you know, in a day. It's about doing what you can with the tools that you have in front of you.
Mm-hmm. If some of the young folks listening have become engaged recently and want to share their experiences, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Or if you're a parent, how do you convince your teen or young adult to become involved in civic, social, or political movements? Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. What if you are a parent and you're wanting to get your child more involved, but you're new to this whole thing too? What do you advise them about how to get their kids engaged?
Just start having conversations. Bring up, again, one thing that you feel passionately about with your child and try to engage them. And chances are, you know, teenagers are incredibly, incredibly smart and powerful. They have probably already thought about a lot of these things. They're probably having those conversations with their peers at high school, or they're reading the news. They're on Twitter. So again, start small, start with one thing, and ask a genuine question. Ask your child what they think about something, or suggest, let's go out and canvass together, or why don't you pick a friend and do X action with them. Create, you know, make a suggestion that feels manageable and not so overwhelming and not like you are forcing something on your teen.
Emma Gray's new book, A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance, a feminist handbook on fighting for good. We know most white women especially voted for Trump. Is there something in here for conservative young women wanting to become more actively engaged?
Obviously, I did write the book with women on the left in mind specifically, but I think a lot of the lessons in there hold for all people across the political spectrum. There is a value in owning your narrative and using your story to speak to other people. I have a section in there encouraging people to engage people in their communities, in their families, people that they go to school with, and have the difficult conversations. Speak to people that you might disagree with. Not because you're necessarily going in there guns blazing to change their mind, but because we need to create empathy and we need to create understanding. So that all holds for conservative women as well. And I think a healthy political system is one where all of our voices are engaged in it.
We just had a Kansas State lawmaker on in our first half, Representative Patty Markley from Overland Park, and she was making the point that when it comes to getting women engaged, you've got to ask once, then ask again, then ask a third and fourth times before sometimes you can pull the thing off.
Women often are taught, again, that their experiences and that their expertise isn't quite as valid, and that's where women need to kind of be asked. And I'm hoping that this book serves as that ask for young women. But I'm very heartened to see that, you know, in the weeks after the presidential election, a lot of organizations like Emily's List, She Should Run, reported record numbers of women stepping up and saying, I'm interested in being involved. I'm interested in running for office. And that momentum has actually kept up until now. It has kept steady, and it's the highest levels of interest they've ever seen. And we're starting to see those women actually run now. And we're seeing that engagement both on the left and on the right as well. And I find that to be incredibly heartening.
What's holding women back from getting more involved in politics? That's the question on the table for our listeners. 816-235-2888 is our number, or tweet us again at KCUR up to date. Emma Gray's new book, A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance, A Feminist Handbook on Fighting for Good. Your book is interesting. It's interspersed with these almost mini history lessons, you know, stories about the shirtwaist workers strike at the turn of the century, the march at Selma back in the 60s, the Women's National Liberation Conference in the 70s. What's the value in including these historical elements in a present-day guide?
I think there's something very comforting in knowing you're not entering any fight alone. You have this wave of women who have come before you, who have gotten us, you know, a little closer, perhaps, to a goal. And when you are, quote, joining the resistance, you are actually just building off of their work. I also think that there's something incredibly inspiring about seeing that young women have always led this charge and that they have been able to create change. You see with the anecdote that I included at the beginning of the book about Clara Lemlich, a 23-year-old shirtwaist maker who really set off this strike that 20 to 40,000 shirtwaist makers ended up joining. And it really made an impact on labor regulations for that industry. So you can create change because, hey, it's already been done. So if they could do it, you know, we can do it today. We have Twitter. We have Instagram. It's even easier to get your message across now.
Yeah, the new name out in the universe there is Emma Gonzalez, a student from Parkland, Florida, who has quickly become a leader on gun control as part of the Never Again movement. What do you make of what kind of impact she's had?
It's incredible to watch. You know, I wrote this book, obviously, far before Parkland happened. And then as it's coming out, we are seeing the lessons that I was trying to get across play out in real time. Emma Gonzalez has become sort of a figurehead for this current moment, but there are so many students who are organizing around her and with her, who are creating real change and finally, you know, breaking through the noise and really wresting the conversation away from adults and forcing the country to listen to them. And it's incredible. And we're seeing the poll numbers actually shift in greater favor for common sense gun regulations. And we have to hand it to these teens. In part, it is because of them.
What is it about young people and young women in particular that can make them such a powerful force?
I think they have an audacity. I mean, first of all, young people are the ones who are going to inherit the future that we create today. There is almost the most at stake for them. And also, they're not beaten down by bureaucracy. They haven't seen things not work out so many times that they're just like, oh, well, you know, we're done. This is it. This is how it is. And I can't change it. They have the imagination and the bravery, I think, to imagine that the future could be better and that they could demand better.
For our listeners, what are your thoughts about young women like Emma Gonzalez, who's taking the lead for change down in Florida, having an impact across the country? 816-235-2888 is our number, or again, tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, these stories you tell in the book, these mini history lessons that I referred to, what's one of your favorite stories, or maybe one who's been left out of most high school or college history classes that you think should be emphasized again?
Well, Clara Lemlich, who I mentioned before, is my personal favorite. Huh. But I also think, you know, Sylvia Rivera, who helped set off the Stonewall riots, is incredibly interesting. Angela Grimke, who was one of a Quaker sister who, you know, testified on abolition. I think that is an incredible example of a white woman being an ally so early to women of color. Mm-hmm. There are so many stories that we don't hear in our social studies classes that should be included.
You know, in the chapter, How to Stop Watching Netflix, you encourage people to actually, this is interesting to me, you want them to steer clear from Twitter and Facebook and to start having tough conversations with people you might disagree with offline. You know, in an age when young people are constantly on social media, why take these conversations away from the internet?
We absolutely need both. That is not to say that conversations that happen on the internet aren't important. There are so many people that you can reach online that you can't reach one-to-one. But we know that real change and real understanding often is a lot harder to reach when you are fighting with someone in your Facebook comments than when you sit down, you're looking someone in the eye, and you are using your story and creating a real connection between that person. And often, I think these conversations are best received when the people who are speaking to each other already have a connection. You know, are you talking to your aunt? Are you talking to your friend from high school? It's a lot easier to reach common ground when you are having that face-to-face conversation with someone who already sort of knows you than yelling at a stranger online.
And people want to know a lot of times, Emma, what's your advice for starting these conversations? I think that's something that people of all ages sort of want to figure out. How do you get the thing going?
First, you need to have both parties agree to actually engage in a dialogue. You can't have a conversation with someone who doesn't want to have that conversation with you. So I will say that first. And also, I think it's good to set up kind of ground rules when you have these conversations. The Women's March organization has a really great toolkit, what they call for daring discussions, and they lay out exactly how you can go through and have those conversations. So I would recommend going to their website and looking up daring discussions, and they give really great practical advice on how to kick off a dialogue that can actually be productive.
Ultimately, you suggest that that advocacy has to come from the heart, and in many cases, that includes storytelling. What are you talking about there?
So that chapter actually wasn't even in my original outline for this book, which is so funny because now I find it to be such an important one. When I went out there and started interviewing all of these women, who, you know, political figures, grassroots activists, almost every single person brought up the power of storytelling. And what they meant by that is that making, you know, the political personal in a very overt way. When you are talking about legislation or you're talking about a political cause and you explain, this is the experience that I had and this is why I care so much about this, it's easier to connect to. And I bring up, you know, the abortion rights movement as a great example of this, where, you know, people are complicating the narrative. Campaigns like the 1 in 3 campaign are encouraging women to come out and share their stories of their experiences with that medical procedure. And then, of course, we're seeing this play out in real time with the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. which is literally a national movement built on storytelling. And when one woman steps up and says, Me Too, and this is my story, she opens up the space for other women and men to tell their stories.
You know, some of the tactics that you recommend in the book are reminiscent of actions that, you know, social justice movements used to use way back in the day in the 60s and 70s. I'm talking about things like conscious raising groups. What do these groups really do?
The groups really just create a space for people to engage in discussion and reach a consensus of, oh, this is why this thing matters. And what I was referencing with the consciousness raising was that after the election, a very close friend of mine invited a group of women over to her apartment and just to sit and talk. And it created this incredible energy. And my friends ended up a few months later raising $15,000 for the last abortion clinic in Kentucky, and then a few months later raising almost the same amount of money for an organization that supports immigrants in Arizona. And there is such power, again, in that storytelling, in that one-to-one or group in-person dialogue. And then you can create the energy that you need to actually go out and take action as a group after. And there's something that feels a lot more manageable about having other people next to you when you're going out and trying to create change than just trying to do everything by yourself.
You know, over the years, one of the big complaints about women in politics is that women, statistically speaking, didn't donate as much money as men did to various political candidates and causes. Now, there are various reasons for that, but is that beginning to change?
Actually, I'm not familiar with statistics on that, but we do know that, you know, middle-aged women, for example, are the group that is most likely to be showing up and calling their representatives. So we know that women are getting engaged in these causes at higher and higher rates, and I would assume that that also includes donations.
You know, here in Kansas City, it can be a little daunting, I think, to think that you can become an influencer on a national level. How do you recommend that young women stay involved from a distance when we're far away from Washington, for example, out here in the heartland?
There is a lot of pressure to make a splash with whatever you do, especially in the social media age. And it's so important for young women to remember that you do not need to change the world overnight. Start local, start small, do what you can. Again, as I said, find something that's going on right in your own community. You don't necessarily need to address the politics that are going on in Washington directly, but those politics are really impacted by the state level and the local level. So start there.
I was going to say, a lot of folks automatically assume that if they can't have an impact like Emma Gonzalez is having, what's the point?
Right. And that is self-defeating, because you might not, you know, get on CNN, but you might change one or two or five people's day. If you are changing your county's curriculum on a subject, that is going to change the way that essentially a generation of students are educated. That has a massive impact, even if it doesn't, you know, land you on the news.
Jen has tweeted us this: my 9-year-old is more civically aware than many adults. It's often a family matter, she suggests, because kids are taught political discussions are rude. And I've heard that before, too. And that always fascinates me. Like, why would anyone assume that has to be the case? Because politics is, in theory, a contact sport, right?
Absolutely. And there is something really negative about the perception that, oh, to bring up politics is taboo, and we don't talk about that, and you shouldn't talk about that on a date. You shouldn't talk about that with your friends. You shouldn't talk about that at the Thanksgiving dinner table. I say, talk about it whenever you want. This is what's going on.
Yeah.
That we're in a moment where we are receiving so much information, and so much information that has a direct impact on so many of us. So to say that it's gauche to speak about such things feels like just a way to discourage people from being involved in their own political system.
You know, some activist movements garner criticism sometimes for not being intersectional enough. Could you explain to our listeners who may not be familiar with that term, this idea of intersectionality? What does that mean?
You know, I wish there was a term that sounded a little bit less clunky and academic, but really at its core, it's very simple.
Yeah.
Yes. Intersectionality just means acknowledging that we all have multiple identities that intersect to create our life experiences. So I'm a woman, and I can connect with a lot of other women on that, but I'm also a straight woman. I'm also a white woman. And so my experiences of womanhood are not generalizable to everyone. And it's very important to remember that when you're engaging in any kind of activism.
No, you showcase that a bit at the end of your book. You have a section about the people and organizations already doing the work. And there seems to be a wide range here, you know, racial, sexuality, economic, and women's focused organizations, among many others.
Yes, I organized that section to be a resource, a starting point for people that want to get involved and want to focus in on one issue in particular. So I do think it's more manageable that way. And I also included a page in the book where you can write in other organizations that I may have missed, organizations that only exist in your local community, because starting small and starting local is so important.
Let's end it this way. Emma, you have inspiring quotes and motivational excerpts from so many people in your book. If you were going to pick just one to share with our listeners as we close the show, what would it be?
You know, Senator Elizabeth Warren says, if you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu. And I think that's pretty important.
What a great line. That's Emma Gray. Her new book, A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance, a feminist handbook on fighting for good. It was released earlier this week. Emma, thanks so much for taking some time.
Thank you so much for having me.
On Thursday, I met the former governor of Massachusetts, that's Deval Patrick, who just might be the Democrats' next big hope in 2020. You can hear our conversation and any of our this week's guests at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Monday on the show, being a mom can become all-consuming. We'll hear about making more time for mom and can be better for the kids as well if that happens. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.